So we start these the same way, which is, would you introduce yourself, please?
I'm Russell Mayo from Sparks.
I'm Ron Mayo from Sparks.
I normally start these with revisionist history, but that's not what you like to do. But I will say that the thing we've done at the end has been done by Todd, has been done by Giorgio Moroder, so at least there's a good pedigree, you know, going here. But I mean,
that's a pretty big buildup, so I can't wait.
The pressure's on. But all kidding aside, album number 24. I watched the promo video, and one thing I will say that you've done really well since 1967 is you don't hype. We're going to serve this up to you. It's going to be a Sparks record, and even we haven't figured it out. So don't. You know, your expectations should just be that this is what's to come. Even with young artists, the first thing I kind of say is, don't try to play Can You Top This every time, because it never works. But I can't even imagine what goes on between Hippopotamus and this one. I got this record and it was everything I wanted it to be, and yet everything that I didn't expect it to be. So how do the two of you, like, you finish the record, and I know you're working on other things. How do you actually call each other up and say, hey, you know what, Russell? You know what I was thinking? I was thinking this.
No, he would never do that.
I never talked to him, actually.
No, we talk as little as possible. What you said about the album being whatever, everything you had expected and nothing that you had expected. I mean, that's, you know, that sort of is the, you know, if there's a goal, there's not a goal each time, but just we hope that that's how people hear what we're doing. And so we, you know, we are sort of on the similar wavelength as to how we achieve that each time we set out to make a new album. So in between Hippopotamus and A Steady Drip, 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 you know, the Hippopotamus was really well received. And so it's also, encourages us in one way. And also it's makes it even more challenging that, you know, you can't just rest on your laurels of your past album or your past 22 albums. And you have to do something that's hopefully fresh and, you know, provocative and forward thinking each time. So we, you know, it's just kind of now it's sort of this innate thing between us.
I mean, but that's kind of, you said something that very few artists or bands can say, well, you know, we have to move on from our 22nd album. I mean, that is a, you know, even over 50 years, right? That's a steady album. And it doesn't always work that way, of course, but that's like a steady album every 2 years.
No, it's not easy. It's not as easy as it seems.
I don't think anything like this, if it seems easy, then it probably failed, you know, to a certain extent. If people can't read into the work that at the level that the two of you play at.
Well, it has to kind of seem, when somebody's listening to it, to seem in a certain sense effortless, but also the person has to kind of think, but wait a minute, that probably was really difficult to make. So, you know, it's kind of a two things going on at once. The pressure is on. You know, you kind of think that at this point things would get easier, you know, both as far as the craft and all of that sort of thing, that you would have learned something to make it all go more smoothly, and it kind of is just the opposite. It gets harder and harder, actually, but you know, maybe that's a good thing, that the end result is something that where you're pushing yourself so hard to achieve something that something special can happen.
Well, this is a little more than She Loves You, Yeah, Yeah, Yeah. No offense to that, by the way, because we all
keep trying. We keep trying to do that, and it just doesn't turn out. I don't know.
You mean, you're like, can we make a simple song? Can we actually just have six lyrics, and can we just stick to to 1 meter and not change in the middle? And can we do a legitimate middle eight? I mean, yeah, I get it.
It's well, not.
It's not really attempting so much to be complex. It's just trying to do things musically that interest us. And, you know, having done so many albums, it takes a lot to interest us at this point.
But I think it's important. And I do this with both, you know, I don't want to say older, but, you know, big artists and younger artists. One of the things you can never underestimate is the power of a real song. And the fact of the matter is that even your most sophisticated, I'll use a terrible word, quirkiest stuff, these are still grounded in pop. And I'm not talking Katy Perry. I'm not talking Lady Gaga. But these are grounded in pop songs. These are grounded in where you came from. It's just that you've brought it up to a level where people have to engage. They have to listen. If they don't, they miss about 92.6% of it, right?
Yeah, our first love has always been pop songs and kind of the restrictions of that whole form, and then also just seeing what you can get away with. And, you know, the one thing we're really lucky with is just that at this point, we don't feel that we're kind of slumming when we're doing pop songs, that this is really what we want to be doing. We're not frustrated, easy listening artists or anything. This is really what we want to be doing. So, you know, we can kind of do it, you know, whether it succeeds for somebody else or not, it's being done honestly by us.
The drip, drip, drip theme is really interesting because and I'm not doing analogies here, but a faucet, you know, if you were really look at those drips, they're not all the same drip, right? There's a lot of different drips happening and a lot of different pressure happening. But who knew we'd be sitting here and some of these songs, and again, I've got my Alexa off in the other room, thank goodness, right? Because right now, I'd be saying, Alexa, get me out, and she'd be looking at me going, I can't understand what you're saying. What do you mean? Do you feel like there's a theme between these songs? Do you feel like there's an emotion behind them? Because they've suddenly become very relevant. And every review I've read so far is like, well, so good that the virus came along because this makes this album relevant.
And I'm thank goodness.
Thank goodness it came, right?
Yeah. No, it you know, there really wasn't a theme that we set out with this album. I mean, it was more... We'd been working on the movie musical where we were working kind of in long narrative pieces and you know, we really felt anxious to kind of get back and work within 3 and 4 minute pop song structures. But we didn't have a preconceived idea this time. I mean, sometimes we do, like with, you know, like Number One in Heaven or Little Beethoven, one of those kind of albums where we actually, there was something we were trying to achieve sonically or stylistically with an album. But this time it really was individual songs and kind of taking them as far as we could. But there is a, you know, in the end, you know, there is a cohesiveness that's kind of, you know, it's hard to elaborate what that is, but they do all seem to fit together in some weird kind of way.
So you had no idea, for example, that you were going to be referencing, you know, Adam and Eve and Abe Lincoln's and Steve Jobs' iPhones next to Amazon. That just was sheer luck.
We didn't at the time. I mean, those things were all, you know, it was obviously all the issues around now were there, you know, except for coronavirus. But there have been other you know, issues that existed at the time when we did the album. So it just happens now that those topics are sort of the newer topics that have sadly arisen fit into, you know, some of the subject matter in these songs, you know, and the one with, you know, with the iPhone that you referenced too, you know, and it was also nice that you picked up on that it's also, using the metaphor, you know, what if, you know, if the meta, if the iPhone had been there during, you know, Adam and Eve's time, or Lincoln giving the Gettysburg Address, or, you know, it comes full circle. This Mrs. Jobs, it's speaking about her particular, you know, issues that she has with her husband, who kind of helped create this thing. So it's kind of, you know, all those references, it kind of brings it to a sort of a different sort of level than just kind of being, you know, upset that the iPhone has come along and taken away people's attentions to better things they could be spending their time with.
So, I mean, one of the hallmarks, and again, Jewish boy from New York, right? One of the hallmarks that I always see in your music is it was Kevin Bacon who said it in Diner. He kind of winked and said, you know, after he broke a plate glass window, he said, it's a smile, right? And that's the metaphor for what you do, because you are doing that. You're breaking through all of these things that if somebody really listens to the lyrics, it's kind of like, I describe it as a Tootsie Roll Pop, right? It's sugar-coated and crunchy and fruity on the outside, and it's dark and gooey on the inside. And the best songs that we all love are the ones that, boy, they're just like sugar, sugar, honey, honey. But then if you really listen to that song, it's a song of desperation. A Perfect Spark single is self-effacing. You're humming it in the shower, and then you realize you're beating yourself up.
Your comment was, really was apt, I think, because there are a lot of times that people kind of see what we're doing and judge it just by that kind of surface, maybe just the humor of the song, and don't kind of look to the gooey center, as you refer to it, in the song. But the hope is always that the song can be viewed in the two ways, where you're seeing kind of a certain lightness, or, you know, frivolousness and then, but beneath it there's something kind of deeper and hopefully a little more profound. You know, it takes a little effort sometimes for a person to get to that level of noticing that, but that's the intention, and are the songs that we really prize the most are the ones that can work in those two different ways, you know, almost equally.
Yeah, and I mean, the two that I want to go to before we kind of get to more general things, the other two songs we have to go to, I mean, they've all got their own specialness, but this moment in time, you know, One for the Ages, number one, that's getting, you know, BBC Six has picked it up. It's getting, you know, it's getting radio play, which has always been a goal of yours, right? It's always been a, holy moly, someone's actually picking this up and putting it into rotation. What's wrong with them, right? You know, so that's wonderful. But then Please Don't F Up the World, right? How recent was that song? I'm just curious.
Well, it was one of the songs. I mean, it wasn't written last for the album. It wasn't, I don't think.
It's just a sequencing thing. It just worked out that way.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. We thought that having that song last on the album kind of ends this whole progression of song. It ends on a certain really poignant tone that, and it helps to shape maybe the listener's impression of the whole album, I think, by ending that way. So, you know, there was debate put into that, whether we should end on that sort of a note or not, because we could have ended on a more upbeat or happier note. But we thought it was, yeah, why bother? We thought it was
why
just,
bother? Yeah,
we
exactly.
just thought it was kind of, I don't know, it was the right way to end this album. But it wasn't, I don't think, necessarily written as the final thing on the album.
No, but I cannot even imagine, and again, I'm looking at the list of tracks here. When you sequence a record like this, right, and you're sitting there going, how does this go together? I mean, all that, you know, is a great opener. And I'm Toast is, you know, starting to get you a little bit in the mood for what's to come. But then there's Lawnmower, right? And I mean, you know, if somebody didn't listen to the song and just like, you know, that suddenly comes out as a title, you know, again, they have to listen because, you know, you're having a lot of fun there with a typical household device.
Yeah, well, don't we hope that people do listen? It's the music has never been meant to be kind of wallpaper in the background. I mean, you can have it on in the background too after you've fully assimilated everything that's on it. But it is, you know, it helps if you actually do listen to the lyrics. And I think just the shifting tones of thing on this album are something that I think are one of its strengths, that it does go from something like you mentioned, something all that, which is, you know, it's a really pretty non-cynical, you know, it's a love song in a certain way, and then, you know, two songs later to go into Lawnmower. It's also a love song, ironically, but it's a it's a song, you know, a guy's love for his lawnmower, and so I think just the, you know,
which
we all have at least once in our lives. So
once in our lives, the freedom of freshly cut grass. Right?
That's right. That's right. The American dream.
So one of the overarching themes, to a point where even your promo people, they only want to talk about the present. Don't you dare talk to them about Giorgio or Todd or even go back to Lil Beethoven. Don't do it. So why do you think that it's gotten into people's heads so deeply? You know, you spend a lot of time talking about not talking about the past. There's a double negative for you.
Yeah. Well, in a certain way, I agree with them. I mean, it's just all about the emphasis, really, you know, because obviously we're incredibly proud of our past. And, you know, the guys you mentioned, Todd Rundgren, you know, he's amazing. If it hadn't been for him, we wouldn't exist. And, you know, Tony Visconti and Giorgio Moroder and all these people. So we love our past, in the context of, you know, the whole, you know, of what we've done throughout the career. But, you know, like you had mentioned, you know, if you're an artist and you're not kind of thinking of what's ahead and what's next, then you kind of get just paralyzed into, you know, saying, well, that was such a great period with Giorgio. We can still say it was a great period, but knowing that what we're doing now is hopefully will be seen next year as being a great period for Sparks too. So it's just all the context that it's all in.
When did you stop caring about, you know, being compared or being an influence to all the zillion bands that I could list, whether it's that Depeche Mode guys or those, right? I mean, was there a moment where you turned to each other or even individually in your head said, you know, it's the price you pay for being us?
Probably about 2 weeks ago, I think. At the time, like when there a band would appear and maybe they had more commercial success in a style reminiscent of what you were doing, you know, it kind of is natural to feel a certain bitterness, but we feel that we've kind of done so much, and that we really don't feel that way now, it's more of a badge of honor whether it's the truth or not, that we feel that we've influenced quite a few people. And so, you know, that bitterness is pretty gone now.
You certainly have fans that show up for everything. They come to your shows, and even in this day and age, and I'm just going to, this was way towards the front, but I have to tell you that I am a big fan of both Housebound Sparks and Lyrically Speaking. These are, you know, you've carried the tradition even today, as we're all sitting here. You're doing all of this with just such, I don't know if pith is a word, because pithiness is a word, But you do it with such class and yet with so much humor. You know, you're bringing joy to people, you know, but that's also hard work for you. But is it also cathartic for both of you to do these things?
It is, yeah, because, you know, there's two ways of reacting to the situation. The way I reacted the first couple of weeks that during the lockdown, which is just kind of be totally immobile. And then after that, you realize that you kind of have to fight through it and figure out ways. Maybe you can't be creative in exactly the same ways that you were before, but there are avenues of that you can do something special, and maybe there's something that you would do now that you wouldn't have done in ideal times. So, you know, that's kind of our mindset.
8 years of vocals to get to Annette. This is like, you know, and then to have Adam Driver, who is really, you know, he, when I first saw him on Girls, I was kind of like, where's this guy going to go? And then I saw him on a couple of other films and I said, uh-oh, he can only play Adam Driver. And then suddenly I realized, no, that's his power, because like Woody Allen could only play Woody Allen when you come right down to it. But it doesn't get better than that in the long run. So I imagine, you know, where's the film? Is the film shot? Where is it at in this lovely moment that we all live in, where everybody's kind of like, oh, we got to shut down the sets?
No, it's completely finished. There's
great.
Yeah, a little bit of just post-production still being worked on, but it was shot last year and finished shooting at the end of last year. And
great.
No, it's an amazing, it's a really special movie. And just in brief, we 8 years ago we came up with this whole project. We wrote the story and wrote all the music, and we had thought it was a narrative project, and we had thought it would be Spark's next album, and that was 8 years ago. And we met the French director Léos Carax at Cannes that year, and when we got back to LA, we thought we should send it to him just to get his opinion about it, because it was a narrative project. And after doing so, he was really excited about this, and he said that he would like to direct the film. And then here we are 8 years later, and lots of pre-production and lots of negotiations with producers and film companies, and then finally it escalated into Adam Driver joining the cast, becoming the lead character, and Marianne Cotillard becoming the lead female, and also Simon Helberg, the third character in it. And so it's all of a sudden become this really, took on a whole other life, and it's been something that, you know, we're really proud of it, because it's a really unique, and it was something that we kind of created, initiated from the ground floor up.
That's great when that happens. When something you've started as one thing actually turns into, you know, so much more. That's always like amazing. And then there's this, when I last read it, there's this, and again, looking back, it's this, someone wanted to do a documentary on Sparks. I mean, you know, this is, it's not like you're Barry Manilow or something, for crying out loud. I mean, but seriously, you know, how much were you involved in it, and how much do you get to kind of say, you know, we don't really want that story about blah, blah, blah in it?
It's pretty, Edgar Wright, the director of the film, before we agreed to do this documentary, we were really convinced by him that his whole slant on it and his whole, just the whole kind of tone of the film would be in the spirit of what Sparks is and in the spirit of what he does as a film director. And based on his films that we really like a lot, we entrusted him to do this, where we had declined in the past with other people that had approached us. It's become a really special project, and he's nearly finished with it, and it's been 2 years in the making, and he's traveled, he and his crew, all around the world with us to Japan and Mexico and LA and London, and filming us in concerts and getting massive amounts of archival footage, and also having a really huge amount of interviews with other musicians, actors, and writers who've all kind of come out to express their joy about Sparks. And so we think it's going to be something that's really special. And also that with Edgar's thesis, that what he wanted to convey was not only that he loves, is passionate about the whole history of the band, but that it is, getting back to your promo people, that it is, that he feels that what Sparks is doing now is special and as provocative and just, you know, as good as anything that Sparks has ever done throughout their history. And that was the whole sort of thesis that he wanted to get across to people, that not only do we have a long history, but what Sparks is doing right now is maybe the most important thing. And so when he approached it with that attitude, we said, yeah.
When people see you live, you know, they're seeing a performance. They probably think in real life, it must be really strange to hang with you, you know, because they're seeing you as performers. And even for me sitting here, it's such a wonderful thing to know that it is a performance. But do you get a lot of people that when they actually meet you, they go, oh, wait a minute, the guy's not just going to stand there and stare and look weird, and the other guy's not just going to do this. Do you get a lot of that? Are people kind of amazed that under the mask, you're just musicians? Yeah,
like when I'm giving my stare at the tomatoes at Ralph's Market, you know, and so to keep the consistency. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to describe how much of it is an act and how much of it isn't, because we've done it so long and it's kind of so natural. I mean, we aren't entirely different people when we're not on stage, but I think maybe it's exaggerated, and you know, just what we're doing as far as being in front of an audience, it just kind of hypes up what we are normally, personality wise.
I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich, and what it is two of your songs on the outside and then anything you want to play in between.